behooves the clergy to be particularly careful in all matters affecting their repute. I go away on essential business, leaving you in charge of the parish, and what do I find on my return? I find you preparing to portray, on the public stage, an uncouth savage given over to lechery and drunkenness, and I know not what.
The curate leaned forward eagerly, raising reddish hands. His fluffy, light-coloured hair had some energy stirring in its roots, which caused a permanent startlement.
"Allow me to explain, sir," he said. "My motives are of the best. I am seeking to portray Caliban as debased, not in himself, but by others. He is first unjustly subjected by Prospero, afterwards corrupted by the bad example of the mariners. The evil of strong liquor is also at the heart of my performance, sir. It is an evil of great magnitude in all parts of England now."
The vicar sighed and pursed his lips and smiled upon his curate's writhings in the spindly, armless chair.
"So the savage is noble," he said, "leading a moral life by the light of pure reason, without benefit of scripture, until we Christians come to lend him our wickedness. This is not good theology, Mr. Parker. I am sorry you have been infected by these radical ideas. You would say, then, that Caliban has a soul which renders him capable of receiving the message of redemption?"
"Yes, most certainly."
"In that, you go beyond the councils of the Church. The baptism of savages is not yet established. It is still subject to debate."
"The main voice in the debate, sir, at present," Parker said excitedly, "is that of the slavery lobby, who seek to deny..."
Belatedly he remembered that the Mansell family had holdings in the West Indies. In agitation he thrust his hands between his knees and held them there, as it were by force.
"We are all children of one father, sir," he said.
"No doubt. No doubt."
The vicar remained silent for some moments. He was not sure of the best line to take. He did not want to embitter the curate if he could help it. Parker was an ideal assistant in the main. He had neither money nor connections to reduce his dependence, and he was diligent and enthusiastic, ready to do all that was laid upon him.
"Well," he said at last, "I cannot allow it, and I am sorry indeed to see that you have elevated yourself in this way. There is only one revelation, Mr. Parker. They invite the fate of Lucifer, who presume to weigh eternal truth in the balance of their own judgment."
The doomed and flaming angel seemed far to Parker at this moment from the sadly nodding plumes of yew he could see outside the window, waving farewell to his stage career. However, as he sat there, still pressing his hands between his knees, a serious spirit of rebellion was born in him that afternoon. Somewhere under the skies there must be, a place where a man of the cloth could play Caliban. With the last hope that the matter might still be saved by dispute, he began,
"I do not deny to Caliban original sin."
But Mansell had raised a shapely hand.
"No more, sir," the vicar said. "This debate has been protracted long enough."
And indeed he had seen from the clock that it had gone on past his tea-time.
"I see I shall have to be plain with you. I cannot countenance this performance, and I must request you to withdraw yourself from it now, today."
"Without Caliban, the whole play collapses, sir. All the work we've put into it."
Looking at the disappointment writ large on his curate's fair-skinned, rather equine face, and at the convulsive way he seemed to catch at his limbs to keep them in check, Mansell wondered briefly if the man might not be something of a hysteric. Too uncontrolled a sensibility there. Parker would not get far in the church. He thought of his tea, which he would ring for immediately on his curate's departure, and of his study fire.
"Let it collapse," he said. "Ruat coelum, Parker. Principle must be served first."
Erasmus paused at the lakeside. Wind stroked the surface of the water and stirred the willows on the other side. He had never been here alone. Never, he felt, really seen this stretch of water, this sandy foreshore. It had been merely the scene of his ordeal as lovesick Ferdinand. Now he was surprised by its forlornness, its air of an abandoned encampment. The awning of Caliban's cave was lifting in the wind, and the fabric at the sides of Prospero's cell was rippling continuously, with a sound like pigeons' wings. He began to make his way round the lake, towards the gate in the wall, which he had so often looked longingly at while chained to the play, waiting to make his appearance. Pretend that wonderment at Ariel's song. Snatches of his lines came back to him now. Sitting on a bank, weeping again the Duke my father's rack. Glancing back across the water, he saw Sarah and her friend, Miss Edwards, approaching the lakeside. She gestured to him to wait. The two girls advanced together until they were some 20 yards away. Then Miss Edwards fell back a little, and Sarah came on alone. She had put a dark cloak over her dress and wore a felt hat with a scarf over it, tied below the chin. As she came up to him, he saw that her eyes had an angry fixity of expression and that her small, full mouth was now tightly compressed.
"I should like some words with you, Erasmus Kemp," she said.
He nodded.
"We could walk through that gate," he said, as if obeying some compulsion in a dream. "And up the hillside a little way, if that is agreeable to you."
"Anywhere you please, it is immaterial." Her voice quivered. He knew it was anger that possessed her, but she was framed so gently that it was indistinguishable from distress. They walked for some time in silence. Beyond the gate was pasture-land, ridged and hummocked, rising to a line of ancient, racked beaches on the horizon. They kept to the path, Miss Edwards dutifully following at some distance behind. As they rose higher, the wind grew clamorous against them, plucked at their clothing and their eyes. Sarah was obliged to turn more towards Erasmus than she might have liked, so that her words should not be blown away.
"I want you to tell me the truth," she said. "It was me you talked of, was it not? Charles has hinted so much."
Erasmus had little humour in his nature, no resources that might have lightened the terrible seriousness with which he now made his simple assertion above the wind.
"I defended you."
"Defended me?"
She stopped at this and turned to face him. The brim of her hat, pressed down on either side by the scarf, made a frame for the narrow oval of her face. She was flushed, her eyes bright with tears of vexation.
"Cry mercy," she said with angry sarcasm, "and to think I never knew I was being attacked. Defended me from what, pray? Who was harming me? And besides...
She fell silent for some moments, as though helpless, looking down to where her friend had also stopped.
"Nobody asked you," she said.
He saw the movement of her throat. She was too tender, he thought, too delicately constituted for such strong displeasure. He would protect her from such feelings. He would be careful with her. That she might have just cause did not occur to him.
"When we are married," he thought again. It was like a refrain. "Who appointed you?" Sarah said with renewed energy. "How did you dare? You have ruined the play. We shall not be able to go on with it now. I believe you intended to do it from the start because you could not shine."
She paused in search of further wounding phrases.
"You are an exceedingly bad actor," she said. "I am heartily sorry now that ever I asked you to be Fernland."
Erasmus said, "I don't care anything about the play. I only stayed in it for you."
She made some incoherent exclamation at this, and turned from him and began walking upwards again, Erasmus keeping by her side. And now the path they were following curved sharply, and they passed into a fold between low hills, where there was suddenly no wind at all. Surprise at this brought them again to a stop.
"You had no right to do it," she said. "I have a brother already who is watchful of me, too much so. Even if we had been engaged, you had no right. Not without speaking of it first to me."
But she had lost some vehemence, suffered an abatement of her anger here in this sheltered place.
"The reason you didn't," she added in low tones, "speak of it to me, I mean, was that you knew I would tell you there was nothing in it. You meant to ruin our rehearsals."
She looked at him, and her eyes widened with an expression almost of awe.
"You meant to do it," she said.
"He made too free with you. He allowed himself liberties."
He was blind to all other questions but this. He wanted her to understand that he was older, wiser, a better judge of what she should permit. Below this, there was an intense wish that she should see and acknowledge her fault. If only she would do this, it would put him in the right. It was the very least she could do to repair the hurt she caused to him.
"Liberties?" Sarah's voice sharpened. "Who is to be the judge of that? Do you stand there and say that I have been too careless of myself?"
He hesitated on this, and saw the girl's chin rise and her eyes narrow slightly. She was more willful, more defiant than he had believed possible.
"No, no," he said at last.
"But you are innocent. A man like that..."
"I found nothing to complain of in him," she said simply.
This bold, unfaltering statement of what lay unvoiced at the heart of his complaint against her dumbfounded Erasmus. He could only stand there looking at her, in this hushed enclave they had found.
"He was perfectly polite," she said.
"He often complimented me on my playing of Miranda."
Her tone had changed. Some note of provocation or challenge had come into it now.
"Can you not see anything except in the terms of this play-acting?" Erasmus demanded.
She raised her brows at this in surprise, real or assumed.
"But all that you complain of happened in the rehearsals of a play."
A sense of being caught in toils came to Erasmus.
"There is a wider view," he said,
but no words with which to enlarge on this came immediately to him. He was looking aside, thinking how he could proceed, when he heard her say,
"No, I found him quite agreeable. He is a handsome man, I think.
He's famous in London, among people of the theatre there." "Famous as a parasite and poseur, I make no doubt," Erasmus said, forgetting everything in the immediate promptings of his jealousy. "He would be famous anywhere for those qualities."
He paused a moment. He knew she had praised Adams only in order to wound him. He said with bitter accusation,
"He touched you."
There was too much force of feeling in this for the loneliness of the place, and he saw the consciousness of it reflected instantly in her face. On the way here, the boisterous behaviour of the wind had kept them separate. Now this magic calm, like a descent, a hush imposed on them from above, brought a greater closeness than being alone in a room could have done. In a room, there is walking to and fro, there is looking at objects, there is glancing at the different world outside the window. Here, there was only one world, at once, vast and narrow, and they were enclosed in it, with nothing to look at but further evidence of the fact. All movement and sound further off, the violent agitation of the trees on the skyline, the distraught cries of lapwings plunging in the wind, deepened the silence they were sharing.
"We must go back," Sarah said.
Only rage with him could have brought her this far, and all rage had gone. Short-lived, as always with her, succeeded now by apprehension at the passion she saw in his eyes, and a sort of pity for his tenacity. All his being was there together. He never flickered, never faltered, he had no reserve. She was swept by a sense of his physical splendidness and the doggedness of his desire for her. This, though not quite an acknowledgement of his merit, came the more keenly for her recent upbraiding of him. An instinct of subterfuge, a desire to reduce the level of feeling, led her to say, almost as if in commiseration,
"Of course, I know he did not have a high opinion of your acting, but I often heard Elizabeth say he was too severe in his judgment, and Mr. Parker said so too."
"Good God!" Erasmus said violently. "I don't care what he thought of my acting. Do you think I would have killed him for that?"
He paused for a moment. His throat pained him with the sudden onset of his love. He knew, with the perception of the stronger, that she was improvising now, that she was spent, in retreat.
"He touched you," he said. "He touched you, and I mustn't. That is why."
The injustice of it released him. In vibrant tones he said,
"And yet I have more right. I love you. I cannot rest for thinking about you."
He moved towards her awkwardly, clumsily.
"You are my life," he said.
He was half blind with the force of his feeling and the terrible exposure of the declaration. She started back a little, then stood still. The flush his words had brought faded, leaving her paler than before. Her breathing had quickened, but her eyes rested on him steadily.
"Elizabeth," she said, "she will be watching us."
"I don't care who is watching," Erasmus said.
Not to deter him, but for the sake of saying something in face of the advance upon her, she was beginning to speak of Elizabeth again when she felt herself taken in a strong embrace and urgently kissed on the mouth. Briefly, but with an unmistakable warmth, She returned the kiss. She felt a strange leaping motion within her as she was pressed against him. For some moments there was a sense of precariousness, as if she might fall if he let her go. Then she pressed her hands hard against him and broke free. Neither of them said anything for some moments. Erasmus's breathing was clearly audible to both. He glanced away from her, back the way they had come. The lake, seen of his tribulation, was not visible from here, but he could see a section of parkland and the upper part of the long-fronted house. It looked unbelievably distant. He felt the warmth of Sarah's kiss still on his lips. "We had better go back," he said, looking steadily and unsmilingly at her. Now it was she who seemed disposed to linger. "Look at the sheep there," she said. "They've found a place out of the wind." Slightly above them, a little further into the fold between the hills, enveloped in the same hush as themselves, sand-coloured sheep were grazing together, their fleeces unstirred by the wind, which only a few yards beyond them was sweeping the grass. "They have found the one sheltered place," she said. She knew that this was a moment she would remember all her life. "Just like us," she said. Wonder at this caused her to meet his eyes, this time with a gaze protracted.
"Say you will marry me," Erasmus said. "Say it!"
It sounded harsh, more a demand than a plea.
"You will kill me if you don't."
"We must keep to what my father said." Sarah was pale still, but she was smiling, and her face wore an expression he had not seen on it before, of promise, or perhaps only a new boldness, he could not determine. "We must wait till I am 18, she said. Chapter 24. The Liverpool merchant crept nearer to the coast through repeated violent squalls of rain, a suitor drawn by obstinate attraction to brave all rebuffs of the beloved. From time to time, the distant arc of the Sierra Leone mountains was glimpsed, only to be lost again in the low banks of cirrus constantly building to eastward. After 3 days of this, the weather clearing, they came to anchor in 11 fathoms. At daybreak the following day, they weighed again, but now, after all the buffetings they had suffered, there was not wind enough to overhaul the ebb, and so they languished under full sail until a fuming Thurso ordered the yawl hoisted out to tow athwart the tide. Late in the afternoon a sea breeze sprang up, and with it they gained upon the tide enough to make anchorage that night in 9 fathoms, just south of the Bananas, leeward of the shoals, and near enough shore to hear the incessant crashing of the breakers, as near as any merchantman of the time dared go. Early next morning, from the deck, Paris had his first steady sight of Africa. Beyond the stretch of sea and the boiling of the surf, a low, forested horizon, pale green, unbroken, giving an immediate sense of subterfuge, of a deceitful sameness. There were no mountains in view now. They were concealed behind the wooded promontory of Cherbourg. The sky was pale crimson in the aftermath of sunrise, as if with the glow of some distant conflagration. The land itself, where the creatures dwelt that they had come for, was hidden behind the green wall. Flecks of white wavered above the line of the shore, seabirds of some kind. It was not a single line, he now saw. There was an interplay, bands of colour or light, seawater paling as the depth lessened, the mist of the breaking waves, the wet shoreline, the haze of green where shore and forest met. The zones lay side by side, blending at the edges, but quite distinct. Some memory tugged at Paris, an obscure sense of recognition.
"Perhaps it is merely the fact of arrival that seems always the same, whatever the look of the place," he wrote a little later in his journal, seeking by compulsive habit now to confide his sensations. "That is, if this can be called an arrival. To arrive, in any happy sense we give it, is to be restored to oneself, to be taken back into community for whatever that holds of good or ill. But we carry our community with us, like all ships.
and it is one that seems unwelcome to the land. We have had this battering of squalls in these last days, and now there is this fearsome surf, which does not let us approach nearer, and the barricade of forest beyond it. Meanwhile, we continue to make preparations and beautify ourselves as if for a bridal. The booms have been lashed up to the masts, the decks cleared and scrubbed again, and the ship's complement of cannon run out. Thurzo means to announce our presence here with a salvo. There are men fixing the awning on the quarterdeck, and others busy fitting out the yawl. This yawl, or longboat, as I learned from Barton, is very essential to our purpose here, where the ship is prevented from coming in close. They have furnished her with spars and sails, and the gunner is to mount a swivel cannon in the bows. Being flat and high-built, she can bring stores aboard through the surf, but her chief employ is cruising the coast for slaves and getting downriver to the small trading stations. Amidst all this activity, there are two men conspicuously idle. These are the hulking one-eyed man Libby and the little man named Blair, more likeable but a great boaster and violent in his disposition. These two have been on deck since yesterday in leg irons, on the captain's orders, for fighting on board ship. Both their faces show the marks of it. I feel a tension among the men these days, which seems to mount with the pace of preparation and the expectation of having slaves aboard. Or it may be no more than the nearness of land after these long weeks at sea. Enmities flare up among them, violent disputes and sometimes blows. These two are now sitting together against the windlass in an enforced proximity that must be in the highest degree. It was at this point that he heard the sudden thunder of the ship's cannon. He left the sentence unfinished. Almost before the reverberations had died away, he had closed his journal and was making his way above. There was no sign of either the captain or the first mate. Among those on deck, the discharge appeared to have aroused small interest. Curls of blue smoke lay over the deck, and there was a sharp smell of burnt sulphur. Wilson, Sullivan, and Kavanagh were still at work on the quarterdeck awning. He saw Deacon and Callie wringing out swabs at the starboard head. These two had struck up a friendship, he had noticed. They generally worked together now. The big, simple one, whose face wore often a shy and vacant smile, following the smaller like an enlarged shadow. Paris made his way forward towards them.
"That was loud enough to wake them," he said,
nodding towards the indifferent line of the horizon. Nothing changed in Callie's face or posture, but he saw Deacon straighten himself and come to a position of loose attention. He was wearing only a singlet and wide-bottomed nankeen trousers. His body was narrow and sinewy, straight-shouldered, deeply burned by old suns.
"That will let them know we're here, I suppose, if anything will,"
Paris said, giving to the words the tone of a question. He had, from the beginning, almost, used his ignorance of the sea, the routines of the ship, the procedures of trade, to incline the men to talk more freely to him, break down their sense of the difference in station that made them distrustful.
"Yes, sir," Deacon said.
"Well, that is, they already know we're here, but by the cannon they know we're ready to trade." The voice was level and flat, rather toneless, conveying a sense, odd to Paris, of dissociation from the mind behind it. With the almost helpless acuteness of perception that descended on him nowadays in any exchange with his fellows, Paris met the blue, rather deep-set eyes. Deacon's regard was very steady and direct, though without insolence. There was something stark in it, as of a secret to be communicated, some unique idea that had been long suppressed.
"To trade for slaves, that is."
Paris spoke carelessly, at random almost, seeking to recover distance, to dispel his too intimate sense of the other's being. He glanced at Callie, who was looking down, licking slowly round his mouth with a blunt tongue.
"Not other trade?"
"Aye. There are ships coming here for all manner of things. Camwood, pepper, palm oil, elephant's teeth. The slavers take teeth often enough, and they will take gold dust further down the coast. But mostly this is to spend for negroes, when they get the chance. It is slaves that make the trade nowadays. That is what they say, who have done the voyage regular."
"And you have not? But you have made the guinea run before, haven't you? This is not your first time in a slaver."
"Once before, yes."
"And how did you find it?"
He at once regretted this question, which he thought must seem frivolous. It had been the result of processes too complex for explanation. Even had they been clear enough to him, his own sense of impending ordeal brought out by the crash of the cannon, curiosity about a man obviously decent, for Deacon seemed that to him. "Find it?" Deacon repeated wonderingly. It struck him as a strange question. His life was a pool not so easy to fish in. Only one of higher station could so carelessly try to do it. He met the gaze of the man talking to him, noted the strongly marked brows, the furrowed lines running to the corners of the mouth. The surgeon's eyes were a strange colour. They looked silver against the sun-darkened skin. Neat and quick in his own movements, Deacon had noticed from the first the surgeon's ungainliness of posture and movement. He seemed not fully at ease with his own body now, as he stood there in the full-sleeved white shirt and dark breeches. "When I was younger," Deacon said steadily, "when I was first going to sea, I made a voyage on a slave ship. The negroes rose on us while we lay at Calabar, with the crew all drunk. They knocked the brains out of the first mate and two of the men on watch. We had to kill 23 before we could get them below. They all but took the ship." He was silent for some moments. Then he jerked his head towards his companion. "Dan'l has never been on any kind of ship before," he said. "He is learning well," Paris said. He had noticed Callie's devoted application to the ropes. Callie was flustered at being so suddenly the centre of attention. This man expected something of him, and so did his admired Deacon. "I used to work in the market," he said. "Portrin, you gets a saddle to put on." He looked with a mirthful expression at Paris. "You have to harden your heart against them, or you cannot do it," Deacon said. He was still struggling with Paris's question. "A man doesn't expect to like things," he added, half to himself. "At all events," Paris said, "here you are." "Yes, here I am. Dan'l and me must get on, sir. We are wanted to lend a hand with a longboat. You see, they've heard us." He gestured towards the land. In some indeterminate zone between the bright surf and the wall of forest, Paris saw pale feathers of smoke rising. They uncurled slowly in the milk-blue haze.
"That is their fires, is it?"
He watched with some fascination these thinning puffs from a hidden continent. No human agency was evident. It was like some breeding of vapours out there, where the spray made the atmosphere vague. Haynes, the boatswain, came quickly towards them.
"What are you doing here?" he said fiercely to Deacon and Callie. "How long did it take you to wring out a few swabs? You pair of lazy sons of whores! Wasn't you ordered aft to lend a hand with a boat?"
"I detained them in talk," Paris said quickly. There had been insolence towards himself in this violent incursion. Haynes had addressed the men without a glance in his direction. "Do you hear me, Haynes? I say it was I who kept them there."
He encountered the glittering, close-set eyes of the boatswain, and caught the slightly rank odour of the oil he used on his abundant ringlets. Haynes was wearing a sleeveless calico waistcoat, and the muscles at his shoulders and arms flexed smoothly as he struck lightly with the side of a hand against the gunwale. There was a constant, bitter energy about him, as if, or so it seemed to Paris, the boatswain was recharged by the abuse and blows he distributed.
"Talking is for below, not for men on deck," he said. "There's work still to be done, Doctor. We shall have visitors before long, judging by the smoke they're sending up." "I know it. I was only intending to say that it was my doing that these two were delayed."
With the barest of nods, Haynes turned away and went aft again to where the longboat was hoisted out between the fore and the mainsails. Kavanagh and Sullivan were packing oakum into her seams and ramming the yarns home as close as they could with fingers and short chisels, Wilson following behind with mallet and spike to drive the wadding in tighter. McGann was tending a small iron brazier, which stood alongside on the deck, with a cauldron of steaming pitch on it. The air above the brazier rippled with heat, and the flat, muffled blows of the mallet echoed over the ship. With Haynes's eye upon them, they worked in silence, but he was summoned by the captain after some minutes. On the strength of the signal fires and the absence, for the moment, of rival traders, Thurso had decided to moor with the sheet anchor and stay some time here. Sullivan straightened himself up as soon as the boatswain had turned his back.
"McGann has the best of it," he said without rancour. "I'm destroying me finger ends on this rope. I'll never be able to play the fiddle if me fingers is reduced to stumps. I will have the law of them for taking away me livelihood. McGann has the best of it. He's just sitting there. Tending fires is an easy lay, as the Black Spy knows well.
McGann, from his position beside the brazier, exposed appalling teeth in a grin which contained no smallest element of sympathy.
"Get your mess good box, ain't it?"
he said in what seemed an attempt to imitate the bosun's menacing utterance.
"Who's the Black Spy when he's at home?" Kavanagh said. "Are you talking about that pissfire Haynes?"
"I'm talking about the devil," Sullivan said. "All he needs is a poker and tongs."
"I have sworn to cripple the bastard," Wilson said.
"No use nursing a grudge," Sullivan said.
"I know Haynes got you a flogging, but brooding on it would only shorten your life. I never bear a grudge myself. They took me clothes off me against me will, but I don't let it darken me days. Haynes took 6 brass buttons off me coat, and that is property we are talking of now. A flogging heals up, but thin brass buttons is worth money. It comes under a different heading entirely. One of these days I am going to walk up and ask him what he done with them buttons. I am waiting for the right moment."
McGann raised himself to look towards the land.
"That smoke is coming from inside by the look of it," he said. "They got slaves there for sure. The captain will be sending the boat upriver, like as not. But you're better off staying aboard if you can. It's killing hot inside there, out of the wind."
The first to see the shore fires had been Hughes. He reported it to Simmons, who went with the news to the stateroom where captain and first mate were checking trade goods. Thurzo nodded, without change of expression.
"Send someone up the mainmast trestles," he said in his hoarse and penetrating voice. "Send Hughes. Tell him to keep his eyes peeled. I want to know the moment they put out from shore. Those 2 men in irons, Blair and Libby, they can be released now. I don't want men in irons sitting about the deck when any of these local chiefs come aboard. It gives a bad impression. They don't understand any process of law or proper punishment. They think it is all done on a whim, as they do things. I know these people, Simmons." "Yes, sir. And you may tell Blair and Libby that they're lucky to get off so lightly. They can do their bloodletting on shore. If there's any more of it on board my ship, I will take the skin off their backs." "Aye, aye, sir."
"That little un is a goer,"
Barton remarked, as soon as the second mate had left.
"He ain't landed 1 or 2 good ones on Libby."
"Why do you talk to me of that?"
Thurzo said, turning sharply upon him.
"What is it to me? They will be here shortly. We have hit upon a good moment. There are no other ships anywhere in the offing, or to seaward of us, which cannot long be the case. I believe they will have prime slaves in their pens there. We shall have to do what trade we can, as speedily as may be. But hark you, Barton, I will not pay over the odds for them."
"No, Captain, I will not go a penny over the market."
Barton raised a thin and cautious face among the bales of brightly coloured fabrics and the shining rows of pans and kettles. The captain was becoming a talker these days. He glanced with accustomed stealthy dislike at Thurzo's impassive face and raw-looking blue eyes. Barton was sensitive to impressions, and it seemed to him now that the captain was making assurances to somebody not in the room at all.
"It would not do to pay over the odds, sir," he said softly.
"I'm up to their tricks," Thurzo said. "There's a man knows these waters better, nor the quality of the blacks here. They're rascals. I'll be too much for them, as I have always been before. And we'll find Saul Thurzo always a jump ahead. I've never sold my owner short. I'm not going to begin now with the last one. He sends his nephew to spy on me, but I will do my best for him just the same. This is a hard trade, and there are disappointments in it that could break a man's spirit and blight his hopes who is weak enough to allow it."
He fell silent here, looking in dark abstraction at strings of glass beads hanging before him.
"It has broke men's hearts, Captain, to my certain knowledge,"
Barton said after a moment.
"But we have a first-rate selection of goods here, upon my soul. There is what would please the most contrarian, pernicious animal among them, and some of them are pernicious difficult to please, as you and I both know, Captain, having been—"
"What I know is not in your province,"
Thurzo said, rousing himself.
"You keep to your place, and I'll keep to mine. I'm just talking to you at present, Barton, that is all. We are in business together for the gold dust, as agreed. That is as far as things go between us."
"Yes, sir."
Seeing Thurzo's head lowered again in a return of that dark musing, Barton allowed his face to fall into an expression of faintly smiling indifference. So the two men stood for some time in silence in that festooned and cluttered emporium, surrounded by goods of extraordinary variety, hanging strings of yellow glass beads, copper bands threaded together, rolls of tobacco, cases of muskets, brass basins and copper pots, iron bars, linen handkerchiefs, pewter mugs, silk rammels, bright red and deep blue bafts, chintzes, checked cottons, knives and cutlasses, and gold-laced hats. Paris, approaching from the hatchway, glancing round the open door, saw them thus, standing silent in this cave of treasures, among coloured stuffs and shining surfaces, and he had an immediate feeling that these two also were on display, among the objects of commerce. This lasted only a moment. Then Thurzo raised his head and saw him and said, "Well, it is our doctor," with the usual intonation of sarcasm. But Paris could not return so soon to the tone of their everyday dealings. Whether he knew it or not, Thurzo for the moment was transformed. Bareheaded here, with his square-set figure and greyish poll, his attention momentarily disabled or distracted among sheen of cloth and gleam of metal, the reflecting surfaces of knife-blades and mirrors and beads, it was possible to think of him as a stout and deferential ironmonger or draper. Almost, Paris expected to see an apron on him. Then he turned his head. The light fell on the square cage of his temples and jaws, and the trapped and furious eyes within it, and the impression vanished. Paris began to speak, but he was interrupted by a sharp, wailing cry from above.
"There they are," Thurzo said. "Mr. Barton, I want the brandy we drew off hoisted below the quarter-deck awning. I want you to speak to Johnson and make sure he primes the swivel guns. The small arms will remain under lock and key, but you and Simmons and Haynes will carry pistols, if you please. Aye, aye, sir."
Barton was already out of the room and making for the hatchway.
"As for you, sir," Thurzo said, "I shall want you up on deck with me. You'd better wear your hat. Hats always impress these people. A naked-headed man is not rated so high with them."
He had himself donned a cocked hat. Under its shadow, his eyes seemed to have retreated further. Something like a smile touched the corners of his mouth.
"You may find yourself with something to do at last, Mr. Paris," he said.
Paris went back to his cabin to fetch his hat. He had only the low-crowned black one, which he had worn on his visit to the Kemps, and which had, unknown to him, aroused such antipathy in his cousin Erasmus. He put it on, for lack of anything more imposing, and ascended hastily to the deck. Here, for the moment, there seemed only what there had been before, the hot sun, the welcome breath of the northern trade wind, the distant thunder of the surf. The tapping of Wilson's mallet continued to be heard. There was a smell of hot pitch, and black fumes of it were hanging everywhere. Standing on the after-deck, some yards from Thurzo, he heard the boatswain order McGann to take the cauldron off, but leave the brazier in place and keep it fed. Looking towards the shore, he saw at first nothing different. There were the changing depths of the water, marked by shifts to paler colours, the plunge and seethe of the waves as they broke on the shore, and the distant iridescence of the spray, which was flung high, higher than the level of the deck, as high as the ship's cross-trees, it seemed. Beyond this was the veiled forest. Straining his eyes through the dazzle of the surf, he saw at last the dark shape of the canoe, rising up to the line of sight, like a piece of sediment in a shaken bottle. It rode a crest for appreciable moments, on a course slightly athwart the ship. He heard, or seemed to hear, the blare of some instrument, like a trumpet, and a rapid pattering of drums. Then the canoe had plunged into a trough among the waves, and vanished from view as completely as if it had never been, as if the sight of it had been mere illusion, product of strained eyes, trick of light. It was in this dreamlike interlude that Paris knew suddenly why this coast had seemed in a way familiar amidst all its disturbing strangenesses, why he had felt at first sight of it something tug at his memory. Those parallels of colour and light had reminded him of his boyhood in Norfolk, fishing from a rowboat, looking shoreward when the tide was on the ebb, the pale striations of the shallows, the constant fret of surf and strips of half-dried sand beyond, pale gold, with stretches of gleaming wet between, layer on layer, always merging and always distinct, like the plumage of a bird, he thought, like wing feathers. He felt homesick, desperate for a refuge. In these few moments, with the canoe still lost to sight, an urgent desire for escape came upon him. Not only, he realized, from the thraldom of the present and the ordeal he sensed coming, the scenes he had remembered belonged to his youth, to the days of his courtship. He had come with Ruth to those beaches in the early days of his marriage. It was what had happened to Ruth that he wanted to flee from, his part in it, the desolation of his life. These stood connected, in a way he could not properly understand, with what he now stood waiting for. Somewhere within him, words of a prayer formed, drop by drop, as if by some process of distillation, independent of his will. Take this from me. Let nothing more be required of me. Let me go back to the time before such things were done, such things were possible. But he knew there was no such time. The canoe rose to sight again, nearer now and more distinct, broadside to the ship, and Paris saw that it was indented or fretted with heads. He had time to notice, before the craft bobbed down again, the processional, frieze-like effect of this, enhanced by what seemed some shared and ceremonial burden. At the prow, a man was sitting upright, wearing a high-crowned hat. One of that frieze of heads raised a tubular object as though to drink. The bugle blast came again over the water. They watched as the long canoe was steered through the zone of the surf with amazing dexterity. In the calmer water, her progress was swifter and more direct. Soon she was lying alongside. The hatted figure at the prow had got to his feet, holding to the ship's accommodation ladder for balance. He was a tall, obese man, the colour of dry clay. In addition to his gold-laced tricorn hat, he wore a pair of linen drawers, a cutlass, and a necklace of feathers. He was flanked by several men armed with muskets. One of these had also a drum between his knees, and another a small bugle round his neck. All of them, chief and escort, were smiling broadly. Paris looked down at the bound figures in the waist of the long canoe. That frieze of heads had been theirs. There were 10 of them. 5 men, 2 boys, 2 women, and a girl, all completely naked. They sat in silence, their arms bound behind them, and their heads forced upright by means of a common yoke. It was the projections of this that had looked so strangely ceremonial at a distance. They were lighter in colour than the boatmen, who were coal-black and heavy-browed, and had a muscular development of chest and arms such as Paris had never seen before. He could see the deep rise and fall of their breathing as they rested on the long paddles. He saw that Barber, the carpenter, was standing near, and remembered he was an old hand on slave ships. "The boatmen seem a different people from the captives," he said. Barber had lit a pipe in the interval of waiting. "Aye," he said. "They are crew people. They belong to the coast. No one else can get these skiffs through the surf. The slaves are from inside the country." "And are they never made captive themselves?" "The crew?" Barber grinned round the stem of his pipe. It was clear he found this question funny. "Who would do the paddling?" he said. "Not those other beggars. They've probably never seen the sea before." "Never seen the sea?" Paris peered down over the side again. "But in that case..." The man standing in the canoe was still grasping the narrow accommodation ladder. He looked to Paris now as if he might have mixed blood. He made a kind of military salute with his free hand, and turned a beaming face upwards.
"Welcome, Liverpool!" he called. "Captain Thursu! Hallo! You remember me? You remember King Henry Cook?"
"It is that fat scoundrel Yellow Henry," Thursu said to Barton. "One of those women has got fallen breasts. I can see it from here."
"I remember you fine," he called down. "Come up! Welcome aboard!"
Yellow Henry was beaming still, but he made no immediate move to accept the invitation.
10 prime slave!" he shouted.
On the words, the drummer struck his drum a number of times, and the bugler tilted up his instrument and elicited a short series of ear-splitting notes. Yellow Henry smiled through this, holding his hat. Still, he made no move to mount the ladder. Thurzo nodded his head as if in appreciation of the music.
"Bring up you slaves for look-see," he said. "You know me. You know Thurso. No panyar with Thurso."
"What is panyar?" Paris said quietly to Barber. "That is kidnapping, stealing people for slaves." "But that is what we're doing, isn't it?" "No," Barber said. "What we're doing is buying slaves. Some skippers go in and take their own slaves, without benefit of dealers. They even takes the dealers for slaves sometimes. That's why these fellows are grinning so much. They're afraid of being took themselves."
Paris watched the slaves unbound and the halters taken off them, watched them forced up the ladder one by one. Yellow Henry's attendants, all steadily beaming, prodded them on with their cutlasses. The girl was very young, he saw now, hardly out of puberty, with high, small breasts and a thin down of pubic hair. He saw that there were tears on her face, though she made no sound. The faces of the others were fixed and expressionless, from exhaustion, it seemed to Paris, but their eyes showed too much white as they came onto the deck. Some final, useless reluctance made him move away from the opening where the ladder was let down. Last on board was the king himself, his arrival signalled by a fanfare more prolonged than any yet. He shook hands with Thurso, smiling still, breathing heavily from the climb. His attendants formed up on either side of him, clutching their muskets loosely. They were motley band, all wore cartridge belts across their bodies. One or two sported cocked hats, though not so magnificent as their chiefs. One wore a dishevelled grey wig, another a lace shawl. All cast uneasy glances round them.
Barton, the king said, "you keep it strong."
"Can't complain,"
Barton raised his narrow face and grinned.
"You have got a memory for names, ain't you? This here is Mr. Paris, our doctor."
"Ah, Paris, that a good hat."
Yellow Henry smelled strongly of rum, but he did not seem unsteady. There was spray on his gold-laced hat and on his sparse grey chest hairs and grossly swollen belly. The slaves, whom he affected now to ignore, were huddled behind him against the rail, guarded by members of the crew armed with whips. His own people stood in a semicircle around him.
"You Liverpool?"
he inquired of Paris.
"Norfolk."
"Norfolk? Ha ha!"
Yellow Henry glanced at his followers.
"You know fuck now! We got business!"
There was a general guffaw at this, in which some members of the crew took part.
"Fuck later!"
Yellow Henry said, encouraged.
"Bristol, trash place!"
he added after a moment.
"Bristol, shippies, no give dash!"
He took a pace and spat with delicate contempt over the side.
"You got dashy for crewmans?"
he said.
"I am going to bust that one."
Paris heard someone say behind him. Turning, he saw Tapley and McGann standing together. He did not know which had spoken. He thought Tapley. Both wore a similarly gloating expression. They were looking at the girl slave, who had not changed position since being thrust onto the deck. Her head was lowered, and sun glinted on the tight springs of her hair. She stood in a position of frozen modesty, shoulders hunched forward and wrists crossed over her genitals. It came to Paris with a certain surprise that she, and all these people probably, the men too, were accustomed to being clothed below the waist.
"We will talk about Dashy when we have had a proper look at the goods," Thurso said in a tone almost jocular. "Have a seat here in the shade. Will you take a dram while the slaves are being looked over?"
"Brandy,"
Yellow Henry conceded. He settled his bulk with dignity, at the same time darting looks to left and right of him.
"These chiefs also like dram,"
he said, indicating his escort.
"Mr. Paris,"
Thurso said, with a sort of ponderous and malignant courtesy,
"go forward and take a look at what they've brought, if you please. You'd better go with them,"
he added to Barton.
"Aye, aye, sir."
Barton's eyes had been on the barrel. With visible reluctance, he stepped alongside Paris towards where the slaves were clustered. He had pistol in his belt and a broad-thonged whip of plaited leather in his hand.
"It is teeth and eyes you look at first," he said moodily. "These beggars is up to all manner of tricks."
Paris thought he must mean the traders. The captives looked past all tricks, save that of endurance. He had taken himself in hand. This was a medical examination he was about to conduct, not different in essence from others he had conducted. Nevertheless, It was with a continuing sense of not being fully responsible, of acting under duress or in some sort of preordained ritual, that he now approached a tall negro on the outside of the group, took him by the wrist, and sought to draw him forward a little. Why he began here, he could not have said. The man had raised his eyes at their approach, unlike the others, and Paris had seen him hold back on the climb up the ship's side. He had been struck several times with the flat of a cutlass. He hung back now. Paris had to use some force. Seeing it, Libby stepped forward with an oath and struck with his whip at the negro's flank. The man gasped and started at the blow, and his head shook, but he uttered no other sound. Libby would have repeated the blow, but Paris raised his left arm as a barrier. The man came forward now without resistance. Across his chest and shoulders, Paris saw the weals of some earlier beating, edged with blood. The arm he held was trembling through all its length, with a continuous vibration, like a leaf in a faint current of air. Again, like a refuge, memory came to Paris, an exhausted swallow on the beach. He had warmed it between his hands, felt the pulse of fear pick up with the return of warmth until its whole body was a single vibration of the terrified heart. But not terror only, he thought. There had been some indomitable hope of life in the bird. With the same sense of compulsion, like that attending some quest or mission in a dream, he met the dark and somehow impersonal regard of the negro, the eyes at a level with his own, fathomless and shallow in the bony sockets. He faltered for a moment at the gaze of these eyes that did not see him, did not know what they were seeing. The man was stricken with the openness of the place. He was sightless at his own exposure. Paris felt sweat gathering inside the band of his hat. The enveloping glare of the noon sky was all around them. With a slight grinding of the teeth, a simulation of savagery without which he could scarcely have proceeded, Paris seized the negro's lower jaw and forced it open. There was no trace of saliva in the mouth, but tongue and gums were perfect, the teeth immaculate.
"Good mouth," Barton said in his ear. "They chews on a piece of bark."
With Barton murmuring at his side like some confidential assistant, full of hints and instances, he peered at the negro's eyeballs and into the pink walls of his ears. He prodded his chest and listened to his heart and felt the glands of his throat. He examined the surface of the body for evidence of disease, but found only the whip marks and extensive contusions in the upper arms caused by his bonds. He had been bound very tightly, and for considerably longer than it had taken to ferry him from shore.
"Don't forget the cock, Mr. Paris," Barton said. "See to pleasure. Lay hold his arms, Libby, and he sometimes strike out. Big gun, ain't he?"
The man was circumcised. Paris drew the loose skin back to look at the whole crown of the penis. He was aware again of that light, continuous trembling. He spread the man's thighs to look for venereal ewes in the region of the groin. There was nothing. Straightening up, he saw the fluttering of fear or shock at the base of the negro's throat. The man panted suddenly, a single deep gasp. His eyes were unseeing.
"He's in good condition," Paris said.
He experienced a momentary giddiness.
"I must have got up too suddenly," he thought. There was a sweetish, musky odour in his nostrils. "Let's have a look at his arse," Barton said. "Get him down on his knees. Get his head down, Deacon, will you? And you, Callie, press him by the nape." "You fool, what are you doing? I want his head touching the deck and his tail in the air. That's right. You've got to be up to their tricks, Mr. Paris. I've known these rogues of dealers to plug up slaves' arses with corks to keep in the bloody flux long enough to sell them. You wouldn't credit what they will stoop to."
"I think I would," Paris said. The examination seemed to have passed out of his hands. He looked away from the bowed form of the black man, still a stone on the deck, to the sea, the distant wildness of the surf, the wall of forest beyond. They had come from somewhere behind there, perhaps from far inland. They were forest people. It came to Paris, like so much these days, as a shaft, a missile that found him, which he would have avoided if he'd been able. Broken sunshine, river banks, clearings of villages, always cover somewhere near, always enclosure. And now, this terrible openness of sea and sky.
"We have got to make him caper," Barton said cheerfully.
He was his usual loquacious self now, having apparently recovered from his disappointment over the rum.
Make sure he has full possession of his limbs, he said. Step back, Mr. Paris, out of the line of the whips. Let us see the brute jump a bit. They're idle devils. Here, you beggar, like this.
He jumped up and down and kicked out sideways.
Like that, you savvy? Course you do same ting me. Jump, damn you. Here, Kavanagh, wake him up with your whip, will you?
The negro panted when he felt the lash, and seconds later cried out on a high-pitched note that sounded more of despair than pain.
He has given us a song when we wants a dance, Libby said with a grin, turning his good eye round on his henchman Tapley. That's it! Oopla!
Barton clapped his hands. The negro had begun a shuffling motion, kicking out his feet and flapping his arms. Paris, again with a sense of being impaled on his own perceptions, saw that thick tears had gathered in the man's eyes.
"We have one to start with, Captain,"
Barton said, going up to Thurzo, where he sat under the awning with the king.
"Prime male, about 30 years old, no pox, no flux, clean as a whistle."
"We'll start with him, then," Thurzo said. "Tell Mr. Paris not to waste his time on the older woman. She's got fallen breasts. I won't buy her. You savvy Thurzo," he said to Yellow Henry. "We do trade maybe 5-6 time. What you bring me woman dugs down her belly? You savvy damn well I ain't go buy dat one."
Yellow Henry's smile disappeared, and his face settled for some moments into lines of sullen savagery.
"She one fine slave," he said, "worth 50 bar. She cotched together with de girl. Turns out she dat girl's mother."
"What is that to me?" Thurzo said. "She's not worth transporting. You can't get any sort of price for a drop-breast woman. No, she goes back ashore. I'll keep the girl if she's sound."
"She's sweet, sweet,"
Yellow Henry belched and began to smile again.
"One more drams," he said,
holding out his glass. "She's sweet cunny, that one. Look how she holding it. She not bampot woman. Nobody been inside. Keep her hand over it like a bird fly out."
He rolled his bloodshot eyes roguishly.
"Bird go fly in," he said.
The king's bugler laughed loudly at this witticism, and half raised his bugle as if to deliver a blast, then appeared to think better of it.
"Whoosh!" he laughed. "Bird fly in!"
Thurzo had not smiled at the sally.
"We go below now. Look see goods," he said. "We got plenty fine thing. Yes, you can take some men with you, but they'll have to wait at the door. There's no room inside. You'd better come down with us," he said to Simmons. "Barton stays up here with the doctor. Haynes, stand by the brandy."
They were below a considerable time, during which Paris, with his mentor always at his side, proceeded with the examination of the slaves. The last of the 5 men had a hard crust on the pinnae of the ears, a concretion oddly similar to the deposit Paris had known to form on the surface of the joints in cases of gout. There was also a tumour-like swelling in the groin, which had broken at the surface to excrete a gum-like substance.
"You see that, Barton?" he said. "See how hard it is along the edges? It has made a kind of rim round the ulcer."
In the interest of this, he forgot for a moment where he was, what he was doing.
"The wound is like a crater," he said. "I've read of this somewhere."
He began a careful palpation of the arms and legs, the short and thick-set negro submitting with a sort of exhausted docility. Close to the surface, quite distinct to the touch, he found a number of small, tumour-like swellings. Beneath the dark skin he could discern a reddish colouring around them.
"Been eating dirt, ain't you?"
Barton looked bored.
"They eats dirt," he said.
Paris took off his hat at last and felt a reviving breeze on his head.
"Nothing to do with what he's eaten," he said sharply. "This man has yours. I've never seen a case of it before, but I remember now to have read of it in Jacobus Bontius and his book on diseases attending the negroes. He describes exactly this raspberry colouring of the tubercles and the hard, burny edges of the ulcerations."
Paris broke off. His voice had begun to sound strange in his ears, at once remote and insistent, as if he were reciting in an echoing room. He looked briefly down at his hat. On a sudden violent impulse, inexplicable to himself at the time, and terribly startling to the diseased negro before him, he took it by the brim and pitched it like a quoit, with all the strength of his arm, clear over the side, where it went skimming with a long and graceful trajectory into the sea.
Unfortunately, he continued with unmoved countenance and quickened breath, there is some confusion in Bontius's treatise, as he uses the same word to describe the papules of yours and those of syphilis, whereas, as far as is presently known, yours is not necessarily transmitted by sexual intercourse, but by direct contact of the infectious.
Glancing round, he found himself an object of general scrutiny. Even the slaves had raised their eyes to follow the bird-like skim of his hat. Barton was looking at him with an expression of particular attention.
"I would need to keep this man under observation,"
Paris said. "Under observation?"
the mate said.
"That's a good un. Why do you pitch your tile overboard, Mr. Paris?"
"To tell you the truth, I don't know," Paris said. He met the eyes of the diseased negro. They were muddy, and there was a sort of remote terror in them.
"It was mine to dispose of,"
he said heavily. He felt again the hot